Brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. Plus, receive premium travel benefits like access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. Unlock a whole new world of travel with the Capital One Venture X Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
This is Jonathan Strickland from Tech Stuff. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and there's Jerry Roland. Yeah.
Jerry said right before she pressed record, I'm sleepy. 3, 2, 1.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't hear.
You didn't notice that, did you?
I was just memorizing or practicing what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry. Well, go ahead.
I just did.
Oh.
I was successful.
You're practicing, hey, welcome to the podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Should we talk fiddles?
Yeah. Chuck Fiddle DD. Let's do.
I bought one a few years ago, by the way. And took one lesson.
Uh-huh. And you became an expert?
Yep. No, that's just me, man. That's how things go with me. I have a lot of things that I've been like, I'm going to do this.
Got a lot of balls in the air.
Yeah, specifically musically. I bought a steel guitar and didn't learn to play that. Sold it.
Okay.
I bought a keyboard and was going to learn to play piano. Didn't do that.
Okay.
Bought the violin. So, I'm keeping the violin, though.
Okay. So you're stimulating the economy.
Yeah, pretty much. And I usually keep just like sell that and use that money to buy the next thing I don't play.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I know how to play guitar, so I'm kind of realizing at my age, like, maybe that's all it's going to be.
You're a guitar man, like Brad said.
Yeah, but I used to want to be like, man, by the time I die, I want to be able to play all the stringed instruments.
Gotcha. So
that was my goal.
Yeah.
And I've learned one.
I mean, that's more than some people. I don't know how to play any stringed instruments. So.
Yeah, but you don't care to, it sounds like.
No, I mean, so you consider the piano a stringed instrument?
It's got strings.
So, yeah, is it percussion or is it string or is it both?
Well, a little hammer hits the string.
Right, percussion.
Yeah, interesting. Whereas a harpsichord is plucked.
Yeah, I don't know. Talking piano.
Yeah.
I wish I could play the piano. I'd like to learn that one day.
Right? My brother took lessons as a kid and my sister, but I didn't.
Oh, and, yeah.
Scott can still play a little bit today.
Of course. Hey, Scott.
Super bro. So the fiddle, a little history here before we get into the man.
Mm-hmm.
The fiddle or violin, there's no difference, by the way.
Is that right?
Yep.
It's just one's pronounced one way and the other's pronounced the other way.
Yeah, it's a little, and I thought there was a difference when I bought mine. I was like, well, what's the difference? And it's just in how you play it.
They're like, hillbillies play fiddles.
Yeah.
Other people play violins.
Exactly. So the fiddle at first was not a well-regarded instrument. It was thought of as a sort of a cheap tavern instrument, you know, like you'd get drunk and hop up on the table at the tavern.
Really?
And beat out a little Irish jig.
Really?
Yeah, and it didn't have a good reputation.
When?
Well, I mean, this is the 16th century.
Okay, so then, initially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
right, I'm with you. Okay. Hanging on.
And even in parts of Italy at first, the church ordered the destruction of violins. They were so, like, looked down upon. And then a lady named Catherine de' Medici got on board, and she's like, this thing is wonderful.
Sure.
I'm going to order 38 of them for my court from this guy named Nicholas Amati, who was the grandson of the great violin maker Andrea Amati. Actually, she probably bought them from Andrea. If it was the 1500s.
Right.
And, yeah, it was 1564. And, that was it. Things started to change. And that's literally what kind of led the violin down a path of respectability.
Yeah, once you introduce it into court,
sure,
people tend to follow suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Amatis lived in a place called Cremona, Italy.
That's right.
And Cremona, because the Amatis lived there, who were basically the de facto inventors of the violin, cello, and viola as we recognize them today.
Yeah.
Because that's where they were from, Cremona became the center of violin production.
Yeah.
Stringed instrument production.
Plain and simple.
Yeah, which is pretty neat. Like the idea that that's where violins came from and that they're that recent in origin.
Yeah.
And of course it goes further back than that. Like lutes were obviously around long before the violin.
Sure.
But again, if you look at a violin today and say, oh, that's a violin, you can thank the Amatis of Cremona for making that recognizable to you.
Yeah. And here's another cool little fact. The fancy, beautiful shape of a violin is not for aesthetics. It is all about the sound that it makes.
The violin doesn't give a damn whether you think it looks good.
Well, it turned out to look beautiful, but all those curves allow for equal resonance of all the notes. If it was more basically shaped, certain notes would sound better than others.
Huh.
So that allowed the entire fingerboard to sound wonderful.
Well, plus also, if you look at a violin face on.
Sure.
If you go down the sides, in the middle, it's cut in.
Yeah.
Those are called C-bouts. Those actually have a practical purpose, I'm sure, in addition to helping produce sound. But it allows the bow to play the strings on either side without hitting the body of the violin.
Yeah.
Pretty clever.
It's really hard to play. I can't stress that enough. It's like, I thought, this is not so different than a guitar. Like, I'm just holding it under my neck and using a bow instead of fingers.
That's got to be a pretty big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah, sure. Fingers, bows, totally different. You're born with one. The other you have to, like, buy.
Well, it's a combination of pressure on a string, angle of the bow on the string.
Pressure from your parents.
Placement of the bow on, like, as far as how far down it is, up and down the violin. Mm-hmm. Speed.
Sure.
It's like there's like 10 different things that go into making a sound on a violin that you have to do successfully all at once. It's really, really hard.
Yeah.
Like I was intimidated and went, in the closet you go. Maybe my daughter will play one day and it will be waiting for her.
Nice.
So we'll see. But should we go over the parts? I know you mentioned the C-bout.
Sure. Well, C-bout's my favorite, so you take it from there.
Well, if you look at a violin, you got the very... above those little tuning pegs, which are contained in the peg box, you've got the scroll, which is that kind of curvy, lovely, fancy piece at the top.
Yeah.
Then you have the neck and the fingerboard. The neck goes from basically down to the body of the violin, but the fingerboard continues on through it.
Mm-hmm.
The upper bout, the lower bout, and then that C bout you mentioned, which is also called the waist.
Yeah.
Then you have your two F holes cut on either side.
Yep, the fancy holes.
Yeah, they look like Fs. Then you have your bridge, which is the very thin piece of wood that keeps the strings, you know, off of the violin body itself.
Okay.
And taut. Then you have your tailpiece at the bottom where the strings end, and then the all-important chin rest. And that's a violin.
Bam. Go make one now.
I'm leaving.
So, again, that was the Amatis that came up with the violin you just described.
That's right.
And one of the Amatis, the grandson of Andrea Amati, who I think is credited with inventing the violin, basically, but his grandson Nicola taught a young man by the name of Antonio, Antonio Stradivari.
Ooh, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah. Antonio Stradivari was born in Cremona. They're not sure when. They think probably about 1644.
Yeah, his life is a bit of a mystery, his young life at least.
Right.
Not a lot of great records on it.
You know what? This just jogged my memory. We never explained why Alexander Hamilton would shave 2 years off of his age, even though we specifically said we were going to. Well, that's awesome.
Should we follow up now?
Probably not.
Okay.
I think people would get mad.
Yeah, if you want to know, write in and we'll tell you. Or maybe we'll post it on social media.
I think that's better.
Yeah.
But who cares? We're talking Stradivari now.
Yeah, we've moved on.
Right. So Stradivari, there's not very good records, about his youth, I think, as you said. But he pops up in 1666 at the very, latest.
That's right.
A violin pops up in 1666, I should say. It has an inscription on it, and a label, actually. And if you translate it to English, it says, made by Antonio Stradivari of Cremona, pupil of Niccolo Amati, in 1666.
Well done.
Year of Satan.
And that means he was either a pupil, which it clearly says.
Sure.
Or a bit of a stretch of the truth and a bit of a ruse and a career move.
Really?
Yeah, there's some people that say, and that's why I was wondering, it says some people believe he was a pupil.
Yeah, I didn't get what the...
Well, it says he was a pupil in the inscription.
Right.
But the other thought is that maybe it was a bit of a career move to say, I was taught by the great Amati.
Right. Who's dead now and can't say otherwise.
Maybe, but who knows? I bet he was probably a pupil.
Actually, he wasn't dead, so that would have been pretty gutsy.
Sure.
To have done that, because Amati didn't die for many more years after 1666. So I think the common consensus is that he was a pupil of Amati.
He would have said, he's stealing on my business, so what up with that?
Right. Man, this thing is going to be lousy with that.
All right, so 1666, you are correct. He builds his very first violin on his own. He continues to build violins on his own in his attic, which was apparently the tradition. Attic violin building.
Was it?
That's what it said.
Huh.
I guess that was just like where you would put your workshop.
Okay.
Who knows? Maybe it... I don't know.
Have you ever seen the movie The Red Violin?
Yes.
Great movie.
Agreed.
Like, stick with it.
I think I might have seen that on your recommendation years ago.
Probably.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, really good movie, though.
Yeah.
So he's making violins. He moves into a home in 1680, and he started to get some recognition as a great builder and maker of violins, a great craftsman.
He did, and he was still kind of living in the shadow of the Amatis, but when... Niccolò Amati died in 1684. By this time, everyone said this guy is Cremona's best maker of violins.
Yeah.
Which, since Cremona was the world capital of violin making, they were made elsewhere, but Cremona was like the place where the best were made.
The creme of the Cremona.
Right. That made him the world's best violin maker, and he hadn't even entered his golden period yet.
Yeah. And he was making more than violins. He's making cellos and guitars and mandolins and harps. Pretty much anything with strings.
Except harpsichords.
Who knows? He might have made a harpsichord.
I'll bet that'd be worth a lot.
Probably so. All right, should we take a break here?
Yes.
All right, we'll get into more craftsmanship right after this. Hey, everybody. Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater, perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. All right, so Stradivari is following in his footsteps, but he's also like, you know what? I'm gonna start tweaking this thing,
yeah,
and craft my own brand of violin. And he does so. He said, I'm gonna use some new materials, maybe some new finishes. I'm gonna make that C bout a little straighter than you're used to.
Yeah, the F's a little straighter. The F holes?
Oh, is it straighter? Was that the deal?
I think so.
I know he altered the F hole some.
Mm-hmm.
And something with the scroll, too. Is that right?
He made it more amazing.
And he made the scroll larger.
Big scrolls.
The F holes, not only straighter, but longer.
Right.
Larger scroll and a straighter and stronger C bout. That was like, mechanically, those were the biggest differences.
Right, but he also crucially came up with his own formula for a varnish. It's a very easily recognized deep, deep red-brown varnish.
That's right.
That his violins have. It's very handsome, but a lot of people, as we'll see later, believe that it's possibly the varnish that makes Stradivarius violins so great.
Yeah.
Because when he made these changes, not only was he making these changes to the shape and appearance of the violin, he was also like a master wood inlayer. Like the craftsmanship that his violins had were just unparalleled. They were flawless works of art as musical instruments. So in addition to just being a flawless work of art, they also sounded better than anything that could possibly be compared to it. And what's really exceptional about Stradivarius is it's not just one of those things where like, oh, the name is actually what is really driving it. A Stradivarius violin that's 300 years old today is probably better than any violin that's been produced in the last 300 years, including a brand new one. Like they're only now getting to the point where they can, they've discovered techniques where they can start to replicate the sound of a Stradivarius.
Yeah.
That's how good this guy's violins were. That it's not a joke. It's not hyperbole of how great the Stradivarius violins were. They are still the ones that this guy made by hand are still the best violins in the world.
Yeah.
That's and the most really after. Saying something.
For sure.
Considering how much progress we've made in the last 300 years on just about everything.
And these are, you know, for the finest tuned ears in the world. Like, clearly there are flawless, amazing instruments and violins being produced since then. But for the true, like, aficionado, they can spot the difference, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Like you and I can't.
No, but people whose job it is to identify and appraise Stradivarius violins say that comparing it to a non-Stradivarius, like a knockoff or something, is like comparing a Ferrari to a school bus.
Yeah, well.
It's like that obvious to them.
People like saying things like that.
It's a great quote.
We're just a couple of schmumps. What do we know?
Bev just went, oh.
Might be a new gag. So he and his first wife had six kids. He was good at having kids. He and his second wife, his wife sadly died in 1698. He got remarried and had five more kids with wife number two.
Mm-hmm.
He was great at making violins and making children.
Yes.
Crafting children.
He's great at it.
Crafting little babies.
Yeah. They call them the maestro in the bedroom. You know what I mean?
And I think a couple of his sons even went on to follow in his footsteps. Is that right?
From his first marriage.
Right.
They were schmumps.
Not that second lot.
They were schmumps, though. They couldn't hold a candle to their father's work.
So let's talk about the golden period, from 1700 to 1720 to 25, depending on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. This was the golden period where these violins, I mean, he had really honed his design at this point, and the materials that he used and everything kind of all coalesced into making the best violins in the history of the world.
Right. It was like LeBron's tenure at the Heat.
Oh, well, we'll see. His career's not over yet.
Yeah.
Wow, you're calling it now, huh?
I mean, he made a case for a resurgence this past season, but we'll see if he can repeat it.
Okay.
He was playing on 500 cylinders with the Heat. It was just perfect because he didn't have to be the team leader. He could be one of, like, the leaders. That team had several leaders, and he could be one of them. Yeah. It wasn't like the whole team just pushed upward toward LeBron.
See, a lot of people have the opposite view that was, you know, anyone can get on a team of superstars and win championships. But
no, not necessarily.
To be the one leader is a bigger accomplishment.
I'm very curious to know how, say, like the Golden State Warriors are going to be next season with Durant and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson on there.
Yeah.
Thompson not so much, but like Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, they're like two of the greatest players that have ever lived, not just they're playing right now. How are they going to gel? The idea that Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and LeBron James were all able to keep their egos in check and come together to work together and lead a team together, that I think that's harder than this, just being like, forget it, I'll do it myself.
You think?
Yes.
All right, so Stradivari is making his mark on the world, getting his reputation, and he's making a lot of money. He wasn't one of these. It's like after he died, they later realized how great he was. He was a rich man making and selling these violins.
Yeah, apparently there was a phrase, rich as Stradivari.
Yeah.
Like richer than an astronaut is what we would say today.
Yeah, he was one of the more famous guys in Italy at the time, for sure.
Yeah, and rightfully so.
His crowning achievement, supposedly, is in 1716 when he built the Messiah. And this is the only violin that he never sold, that he kept in his workshop till the day he died.
It was his head stash violin.
And this violin has rarely been played. Apparently one of the sort of things, unspoken rules when this thing's been sold and passed down, is that don't even play it. This one should remain pristine.
Yeah, it's basically as close to a mint condition Stradivarius as you can find in the world.
Well, it's not close. It's mint.
Yeah. And, but I mean, a couple of people have played it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not been unplayed.
Okay.
Yeah.
A couple of bad eggs in there.
A couple of super lucky violin players.
Said, screw your unwritten rules.
Yeah, well,
this thing.
This is before the Ashmolean got their hands on it.
Oh, okay. So post 1720, post Golden Period, he still produced, violins and things, but, apparently his eyesight was going, his hands were not as steady, and they weren't quite what they were during the Golden Period. I'm sure they were still wonderful violins.
Oh yeah, he's still churning out the good stuff, but nothing like that Golden Period.
And he worked into his 90s, so he was building violins for, you know, 70 years.
He worked up to his death, as far as I understand.
I think so.
So yeah, but that Golden Period stuff, there was the Messiah from 1716, the Allard from 1715, the Betts from 1704. Those are just a few of the ones that he made during this period that are still around today. I saw 1,000, I also saw 1,500 stringed instruments during his career.
Amazing.
About 650 survive today. And they tend to have names, especially the ones from his Golden Period, as you just heard.
Yeah.
They have names, and they're usually the name of the most famous player who owned it.
Right. They weren't like Skippy and Old Roy.
Right. Barnabas.
Barnabas the violin.
Right. So there's a superstition among violinists that the more you play a violin, the more a particular person plays violin, the more that violin takes on the character of that player, right? So much so that a violinist or even a cellist or a violist can come along afterward and play that person's violin.
Yeah.
And it will sound much more like the person whose violin it is than the person playing it.
Oh, wow.
And there's a further superstition that the more you play a violin, the better it sounds.
Well, that's not a superstition. That's fact.
Right.
With any instrument.
So there was a study from, I think, 1996 that I came across that found that the more violin wood is vibrated,
yeah,
the more the dampening coefficient is lowered. The lower the dampening coefficient, the longer a note resonates. The longer a note resonates, the richer the sound.
Yeah.
And so just playing it, right, because you're vibrating the wood when you're playing a violin,
yeah,
the more you do that, the more frequently you do that, the better the violin's actually going to sound. So
yeah,
astoundingly, the more you play a violin, the better it sounds.
Well, that's true for any instrument.
Is it?
Yeah, it's called breaking it in.
Oh.
It's like a pair of jeans. That's not, you can identify with that.
Sure. I love jeans.
And you know, a pair of jeans 5 years in are better than they are when you take them off the shelf.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's breaking it in, especially strings with anything with a fingerboard. That fingerboard just, you know, it wears in, those frets wear down a little,
mm-hmm,
and it does get a little bit attuned, I think, to your style.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to do more on musical instruments here and there.
Okay.
I'm putting it out there.
All right.
All right. Well, let's take another quick break, and we will get into all the controversies surrounding just why these things sound so good and all those theories. Pretty interesting stuff. Hey, everybody. Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
So, Chuck, I gotta say, you did a good job putting this one together. Okay. Sure. I'm interested in it.
You know, I had that stuff from the B-side podcast for like 2 months,
mm-hmm,
back in the day.
People still call for it.
And we covered this very briefly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we didn't do right by it. So that's why I was like, you know what? That's a good topic.
Nice.
Let me dust that one off.
Nice.
So there have been many, many theories over the years. Like if the Strad is so revered and legendary that people, experts, scientists are bound to want to crack that nut.
Yeah, like why?
Yeah, like what's the deal?
And it's not, again, it's objectively better than other violins. That Stradivari made.
Correct. Some of the theories, the old theories back then, was that he would soak the wood in salt water. Not true. That the wood was coated with volcanic ash. Not true. that dragon's blood was used in the varnish. That may have been true.
Okay. George R. R. Martin came up with that one.
Probably so. And then I'll, you know, we'll get into the more modern theories. There's really, well, there's a couple of leading theories. One is the wood.
Yeah.
This Ice Age wood, which we'll talk about. And the other is the varnish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Go.
Oh, okay. Well, the Stradivari was working during what's known as Europe's Little Ice Age, which is a period of very unusually colder temperatures. And I think they're still trying to figure out what the heck happened. And as a matter of fact, we need to do like a regular Ice Age podcast, and we'll talk about it then.
Yeah.
But the upshot of it was that because of the colder temperatures, the spruce that was used by Stradivari in the manufacture of these violins grew slower but more evenly, steadier, so that the wood that was harvested from these spruce trees was much more uniformly grained, right?
Yeah.
So just basically really high-end wood was produced by this little ice age. The problem with that being the reason that Stradivari's violins were so great is that that wood was also available to violin makers elsewhere in Europe. And their violins don't sound anything like a Stradivari.
Yeah.
So the Little Ice Age theory, while still, I think, out there, I think that really kind of goes a long way to undermining it.
Yeah. Like, people were really excited about that at first. And I think they're like, this is not proof.
It's a cool theory.
It is cool.
Little Ice Age.
There's another dude at Texas A&M, named Joseph, Nagivari. What a unique name.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's all about this varnish, this Cremonese varnish. Is that not right? Yeah.
Cremonese.
Yeah. I think that's what they say.
Start your morning right with Cremonese.
So, he published an article in Scientific Journal, Public Library of Science 1. It's capitalized for some reason. And he says, you know what's going on here? It's this varnish that he used. Let me analyze it chemically. And what he found out was it's very unique in that it has these things in there that you would not expect to be in a varnish, like borax and chromium.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, so what I think is going on is this stuff, he added this stuff to the varnish to protect it, that wood against damage and infestation. But what it really did was actually weakened the wood and made it porous where it should not be, and that created more tone, a more booming, rich, powerful tone.
Right.
And he got a lot of pushback.
His theory's not entirely out of left field. Like, it's pretty much accepted that if you put the wrong kind of varnish on a violin, it's going to ruin the sound.
Sure.
So his whole thing was, well, why couldn't you stumble upon some varnish that actually enhanced the sound? And that was his idea, that accounted for Stradivari's violin sounding like that. I think he did get a lot of pushback.
He did.
There seems to be, even if he's right, there seems to be a desire among the people who collect and play Stradivarius violins is that we'll never understand what makes it special. We don't really want to know what will make it special.
Yeah.
There's a guy who was widely quoted. He's a violinist from America. His name's James Eanes. Eanes? Eanes. Man. James, his whole view is that he's played a number of Stradivarius violins and other stringed instruments, and he said that there's probably 1,000 things that make them special.
Yeah.
And we can never possibly know what all those 1,000 things are, and there's never just going to be just this one thing that is the key to what made Stradivarius violins so great.
Yeah, I think I watched a BBC documentary that was really pretty great, and they interviewed another violin maker, and he said, you know, it was the right place, right time thing. Like, this guy came along, maybe they had this good wood that was special, maybe he had this varnish that was special.
But they were in the hands of somebody special too.
Well,
clearly.
That was his point, was that other people were using some of these same things and they turned out very different.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was so good at what he did, like, that's the secret. He was just better at doing this than other people.
Right, like how Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade brought the best out of LeBron James.
Well, where I think this Texas A&M professor erred was that he was so bold as to even posit the idea that it may have been an accident. And that, like,
I would say bold is an appropriate term.
Yeah, like, they turned out this good on accident. He didn't know this varnish was going to do that, or the wood may have been even pre-treated with these chemicals,
and he
kind of lucked into what it ended up being.
Yeah.
And not that he wasn't talented, but, like, that's why they are what they are. And people were like, whoa.
Blasphemy.
Yeah. Out. Heretic. So how much do these things cost?
A lot.
The end.
I mean, the numbers are all over the place. Like, one thing will say that the record was $3.544 million.
Yeah.
And then later on, the record was broken with $3.6 million with the Molitor Stradivarius, owned famously by Milwaukee brewer Paul Molitor. That's where that one got its name.
Well, yeah, I agree. And then this says, in June 2014, the Kreutzer had a pre-sale estimate of $7.5 million to $10 million,
right?
But it failed to reach the reserve price,
right? But then later on, another one sold in 2011 for $16 million. So apparently, nobody's really keeping tabs here. I looked on the internet; I couldn't find anything approaching a comprehensive list of how much these things had gone for. But the fact is,
millions of dollars,
tens of millions in some cases, from what I understand.
Okay.
And there are collectors, very, very wealthy collectors, who are driving the price of Stradivarius violins and other string instruments through the roof.
Yeah.
Where if you were smart enough to buy one for a few hundred thousand dollars 20, 30 years ago, it's worth easily 10, 20 times that now.
Yeah, and it's kind of a shame that these aren't in the hands of the great players of the world, you know?
Well, they're in the hands of the great players of the world who come from very wealthy families.
Yeah, or who, like you said, bought one 20 or 30 years ago.
Right.
And that's their, you know, their go-to.
But yeah, it's just another fat piggy thing to buy and own and possess.
Yeah.
The one I have is the most expensive one.
Right.
Fortunately, the one that's so valuable that it's frequently cited as priceless is the Messiah.
Yeah.
And that is owned by the Ashmolean at Oxford University.
Yeah.
So that one's not up for grabs.
No.
Which is cool, because all the other ones are just operating under that level.
Yeah, and the lady in the BBC documentary is a violinist, and she got to hold the Messiah with gloves.
And it's called that because there's a nativity scene inlaid on the back, I believe.
Oh. I don't think it's the back. I think it's in the little tailpiece.
Oh, okay.
This thing is gorgeous, and she was allowed to hold it with gloves, this, like, white cotton gloves. Mm-hmm. And the whole time, even though I knew that wouldn't happen, I was like, don't drop it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, those slippy little cotton gloves?
Sure.
And it just made me nervous watching it.
Did you ever see that video of things that were very expensive things that were accidentally broken that I made years back?
I remember that, yeah.
It's just like, it was tough to make.
I bet.
It's tough to watch, too.
Yeah. Over the years, there have been many, 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 many fakes. As soon as he died, they started pumping out forgeries. And not even forgeries, like just mass-produced violins that they would throw a label on.
At the time, in the 19th century, 18th and 19th century, the people buying the violins knew that they were, like, knockoff manufactured fakes.
Yeah, largely in Germany, right?
Right, but they weren't like, they weren't being duped. It was like, this is in the style of Stradivarius or whatever. Yeah, largely in Germany and Czechoslovakia. And the thing is, though, is over time, these what are now pretty old violins, because they were, again, made in the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah.
They had labels on them that would say, like, Stradivarius Cremonensis Facebat Anno, and then say, like, 1679 or something like that, right? So if you find one of these violins in your attic, and it looks pretty old, it literally says in Italian, this violin was made by Stradivarius in 1679.
Yeah.
You could be forgiven to think that you have just found a Stradivarius violin and all of your money problems are over.
Yeah.
You can go buy more meth than you'll ever be able to do in your entire life.
It might say made in Germany too, though.
That's a big giveaway.
It is.
Yeah. And apparently if you're an appraiser of this kind of thing, you are so sick of people calling you that you can't even hide it when you're interviewed in an article.
Yeah. The one guy even said that, He's like, people get angry when you tell them it's not. He said, because they think they've got a lottery ticket and you have to break it to them. And he said, they get mad on these phone calls.
Right. And they're like, well, do you have 20 bucks for meth?
That's pretty funny. Do you got anything else?
Yeah. If you find a violin and you look it over and it says Stradivarius and you look even further and it doesn't say made in Germany.
Fake.
If it doesn't say that.
I know, but it's still probably a fake.
Well, you can, there's a Smithsonian article about it that has basically step by step what you can do and who you can submit photos to.
Yeah.
To get it basically pre-appraised. Well, not appraised, but just looked at. And they can usually tell from the photos, like, no, that's a fake.
Like, step one, leave it out in the sun and let it get rained on a couple of times.
Right.
If ants are attracted to it, right. It's not a Strad.
Exactly. Yeah, but one of the appraisers makes the point, like, there are about 650 in the world, and they're all basically accounted for.
Right, like we know where they are.
Yeah, and even when we don't know where they are, we would know the ones that we don't know where they are when they surface.
Yeah, and like a stolen one.
Yeah, there was one that was famously stolen 30-something years ago from a concert violinist, and it was a Stradivarius, and it was in the attic of a Milwaukee thief's house.
Wow.
And I guess he died, and his girlfriend took it to an appraiser who's like, this is stolen. I know whose this is.
Crazy.
So it's a very small community. So the idea that somebody's just going to walk up with like a real Stradivarius that had previously been unknown is just most likely not going to happen.
Yeah. The one of the other appraisers said it's like finding a new Rembrandt. He said, we know what he painted.
Right.
We know where they are.
Yeah. Now they got computers painting Rembrandts.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I think a guy left his Strad in the cab a few years ago,
yeah.
too.
Was it Joshua Bell? Sounds like something that guy would do. He's wacky.
Can't remember. I believe that happened, though. I remember
reading
that.
Did he get it back?
I think so.
Only in New York, right?
Jeez, can you imagine?
No, because, again, like these are concert violinists who have almost been entrusted by humanity with these things. Like, here, this is a very expensive violin, yes, but
yeah.
We are giving this to you because we think you will enrich this
and honor
with
it.
Your playing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday it'll be called your last name, Stradivarius. Play it well.
Right.
Don't leave it in the back of a cab.
And then that guy had to get on Craigslist and buy a $100 fiddle.
Right. Yep.
To play first chair at the Philharmonic.
Yeah. Chuck.
Yes.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
I don't either. Good job putting this together, man.
Thanks.
If you want to know more about Stradivarius, you can search the internet for it because we don't have an article on how stuff works. Since I said internet, it's time for listener mail.
This is, we call this from my good buddy Bex, Rebecca Bloomfield. She's one of my pen pals.
Okay.
From the Stuff You Should Know.
Is she in prison?
Over the years. She sure is. No, she's not. She's a delight, though. And she backed me up on my comments about women in science. So I felt good about it. So I wanted to read it. She made me feel better. I hope you guys had a great time in the UK. By the way, she just missed our show. And I think in London by a couple of days. And she was very bummed out.
Does she live there or was she visiting?
I think visiting. She now lives somewhere else.
Gotcha.
So she said, I know you did. I just listened to the delightful history of steam. Anyway, I'm writing to say, bloody well done. Is that a curse word?
I think, like, it's like, very.
Oh, okay. Great. Well done, Chuck, on your comment on what we could have achieved if women had been allowed into the STEM fields from the start. I know this sort of comment can be a minefield for a guy, but I can assure you, you made your point really well. I'm normally the first to jump on non-feminist comments or mansplaining. That's what I was afraid of. So she said, I'm usually the first to jump on the mansplaining, and when you said it, I just said, yes, yes, Chuck, very loudly in my office. I even startled the dogs. Raising children is very important, but men can do it too. All humans of any gender should have a choice as to what they do with their lives. This should not be predetermined because of their gender. So good on you, Chuck. Makes me happy to know that the next generation of women are being raised by men like you. And that's
nice.
From Bex Bloomfield, and she is a graphic designer for Little Red Robot Design.
Ooh, shout out.
And just a nice lady.
Nice. Well, thanks a lot, Bex. Can I call her that, or should I just call her Rebecca?
No, you're in the club.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Bex, for that email and for shouting. We appreciate that kind of thing.
Certainly.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast or Josh_Clark. You can hang out with us at Charles W. Chuck Bryant on Facebook or Super Josh Clark on Facebook or Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can also send us an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, stuffyoushouldknow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Hey, everybody, are you thirsty? Well, sip on pure, refreshing Richard's Rainwater. Yes, it's really rain. Caught clean before it hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's Rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater or the long-lasting and cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. Sip the sky. The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.